Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's podcast, I am going to speak with the winemaker at one of the wineries in my upcoming film, Cup of Salvation. I know many of you have been waiting for the fourth SOM film. It is almost there. This is a little bit of a teaser, and I strongly recommend you grab some of their wine as soon as you can, because as goes with these films, the wine goes away. Everybody, I want to remind you to go to somtv.com. We have a lot of great things coming. We have a brand new documentary on Burgundy that we've been filming for quite a while coming up very soon in the next few weeks. And we also have a behind the glass on the eponymous winery, William Selyem. It's an amazing story of that incredible journey that winery's taken to basically start Pinot Noir at the level it is in the United States. You're going to love that. Go to somtv.com and enjoy that. And also watch this conversation that I have right now that you're listening to on somtv.com if you're a subscriber, and you can see everything we talk about. We film that in person. Without further ado, my conversation with Tamino Mumtazi from Maysara Winery in the Willamette Valley. I am here with a legendary winemaker. That's my title for you.
Oh, I was going to say.
Tamino Mumtazi over at Maysara Winery here in the Willamette Valley. This is exciting. We haven't filmed a whole lot here in the Willamette Valley, which is really unfortunate. Some of the great wines of the United States come from here, but we're here now. So we're gonna make this right. And no pressure.
Thank you. Well, welcome to Oregon. And, you know, we hope you enjoy our lovely, you know, weather here. And it's not raining, so it's a positive for you.
I miss rain. I live in Southern California. I would say that I'm going to try here to pretend like we weren't drinking wine until the very late into the night last night. I'm going to try to pretend that we are fine right now and everything's okay. All right, so
I'm a good actor, so we're good on that.
That's good. That's good. Well, honestly, you know, you have a hell of a career, and I want to get to the fact that this winery that we're sitting in right now not only is one of my favorite wineries that I can name. You guys are a big part of my next film, the next SOM film, Cup of Salvation. So there's a little bit of extra love that I have for you guys. But you know, for you to be a winemaker and have gone all over the world, and we'll get into a little bit of your career, but then come back and work with your family. I'm going to get into whether you regret that decision or if that was the best decision you ever made in your life. But I want to start first with kind of why you wanted to be a winemaker. What was the thing that made you go, this is the profession I want? Is it growing up in a wine family? What was it?
No, actually it wasn't. It was actually from my college advisor. And so I actually went to Linfield College, now called Linfield University. And my advisor, I was studying general math and science, wanting to go into the medicine program, just wanted to be a doctor. And I was talking to him, and I'm like, what do I do? What are the next steps? And he asked me, he's like, your family's in the wine business. Why don't you go into this? And I'm like, that's just so typical of every first child going into that. So I don't want to follow the norm. And he's like, think about it. You're really good in science. You got good math skills. Just like really think about this. And I was like, well, no, I don't want to. And he's like, okay, let's just make a deal. You do a harvest or work for a winery for a summer. Just figure it out what you want to do. So I was like, okay, you know, I'll make this deal with you. I'm going to tell you I'm going to hate it. Just telling you this. And he was like, well, I just want you to not think about your family. They're in the business. Just generally want you to think about it. So I'm like, all right. Came back. So I told my dad, I was like, so I need to find a job for like a couple months while I go to school because I made a deal with my professor. And he was like, okay, you can work here for a lab for harvest. And you can do it like early in the mornings or do it after class, just whatever works with your schedule. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, we'll do that because I had early classes. So I would get done around like 10 a.m. and then drive over here and do lab because they would be done with their punch downs and pump overs and all that stuff. So I could do lab. And actually, that's where I fell in love with it.
The science of it.
The science. Mm-hmm. And I was just like looking at the numbers, seeing what's happening. And I was like, oh, I get it. And I really fell in love with that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And I never got into production at all. I was just more into lab. And I'm like, I love this. I want to stay in lab. And that was like the whole focus I was trying to do. So when I went back to my advisor and I was like, I do like lab. And he was like, okay, so let's figure out what the next steps are going to be. And I'm like, oh, great.
I feel like you made this harder than you needed to make this.
Yeah, I mean, really. I went to the wrong school because I did it. I was like, that's what I was like, oh, great. And when he literally told me, he's like, you have to transfer out. So we're not bringing a wine department in here. You got to go to Oregon State.
Yeah.
Or go Davis. And I was like, okay. Then I started doing the pros and cons of where I wanted to go. And the pro was going to stay in state and stay near my parents. Not saying that my parents were my crutches, but I just felt like having my parents near me would just be a little bit more humbling for me to not forget who I am and everything. So I went to Oregon State and started getting my degree in beer master and winemaking. They did offer me to go to the whole like enology department part, but I was so scared because I would be the first graduating class, and I just wanted to graduate and I just wanted to leave. And I was like, please let me leave college. And also being a fall baby, I didn't turn 21 until like October and like end of October. So right. I couldn't take any of my tasting classes until like another year. And I was like, you're just sucking my money. And I just
want to. It's such a stupid, I mean, the drinking age, especially with education, I just can't. That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
The stupidest thing in the world.
Yeah. So I just pretty much got the degree. And the reason I got a degree was just because that was one of the rules that my father really was like, all of you guys are going to have a degree. And I said to them, I was like, if I'm going to go for this, let me learn about it. So at least I can understand what I'm doing.
Right.
So I finished in 2006, and on Father's Day, I graduated. And I told my dad, he didn't know. I didn't ever told him, I was like, I'm going into winemaking. I just said, oh, you know, I'll take some classes. Mm-hmm. But when I graduated, I was like, oh, I got a degree in beer master and winemaking. So, you know.
So you did it.
Yeah, I did it.
And then you went. So then you went and you did what all smart people trying to get into the wine business do, is you got your hands dirty and went all over the world and
yes.
Worked in New Zealand,
Yeah. So I worked in New Zealand. And while I was in school, I actually worked for a little winery called Bell Valley Cellars that is not there anymore. But I worked for Joe Wright, and he... again, he put me in production, and then I fell in love with production too. And I was like, wow, I really like what I'm doing. Because he was just like, yeah, your hours don't fit in our lab part, but come and, you know, do, you know, punch downs and move wine around. And I just fell in love with like, oh, you can tell a whole story about this.
Right.
Of the vintage. And that's when I was like, okay. And then when I came and graduated and I applied, and I told my parents this. I was like, I think the last name is like killing me here because...
Momtazi.
Because I applied everywhere and no one was accepting me. And I was like, I think they just, you know that I'm like maybe just trying to steal their secrets or something.
Oh, come on. Because you're Persian?
No, I was, you know, Momtazi and I would go back to my family's business.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like, right. Because the name is famous in the wine world. Like, oh, okay. I'm thinking they're like a Persian.
No.
Okay. So it's literally just wine success is the reason. Okay. All right.
That's, I mean, I joke about it sometimes.
Equally bad, but also.
Well, I do joke around that I am a terrorist.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I'm not touching that.
No, but I mean, I was more of that, like, didn't want. So I said, my dad took me in 2006 and said, here, work harvest. And then after harvest, then leave. We have a 5-year, you know, deal that you go outside of the family business. You won't come back to Oregon. We just, no one will know who you are. So
right.
We made that plan. So I got a job at Kim Crawford. And then when I worked at there, one of the winemakers
How quick could you make me a Sauvignon Blanc right now? Can you do that pretty quick?
If you gave me the fruit, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You will have it like in a month. Okay. A bottle in a month. But I mean, so when the winemaker saw me and he turned around, it's like, you kind of are heavy on red production of how many like harvests you've done, we were gonna put you in white production. I got really furious with them. I was like, I don't want to make white wines. Don't care about white wines. Just put me in red. I came all this way for here. Just learn about your guys' styles. And they were like, no, you're gonna go there. So I was bitter about it for like a couple weeks. And I actually will say I'm very grateful they did put me in white wine because
Are we learning a pattern here?
Yes, I know. I am really am learning. I have a hard path. I'd like to go a, you know, a different way, and then someone tells me, no, you got to go this way.
This is also, you know, you and I are both parents, and you're going to get it again from your kids. They're going to do it to you right back. It's just, this is a tricky situation.
I know. My parents tell me karma's a bitch.
Yeah.
It's definitely hitting me.
We are going to get to the Willamette. I mean, it's hard to overstate. You know, this winery, if you're not watching this winery is incredible. It is an incredible structure. You guys grow some of the best fruit in the valley. And on top of it, you make some of the best wines. You also do something that it should be more common, but it's really not, is to hold your wines until you think they're ready to release, which is a really, probably a terrible business decision. But no, I'm just kidding.
it sounds like a terrible business decision.
But makes the wines incredible when you get them.
I mean, there are certain, like, you know, wineries out in not United States, but outside of the United States, you'll see wineries that do that.
A lot in France,
and
yeah.
And so that's the concept that when I came here, and that was one thing when tasting, like maybe being raised on the site and understanding this, was from our 2001 vintage up to like 2006, was our wines are not ready to drink, like that vintage, or you're not supposed to drink it fresh. And what... You know, talking to my dad, it was like, you know, I know that we need to release, but I think we need to release wines when we like really are ready to release, because people are going to say, oh, it's ugly or it's tight or it needs more time. So why do we release
something
like that?
You can control that narrative, yeah.
So why do we do that? And then people would then have a whole time and try and explain to people like, no, hold it. Just really hold it. So we did that. We made that decision for people. Like, we're going to release the wines when we think it's ready and for you guys to drink, and not make that assumption, oh, I need more time, or I need to hold this wine, or why is this wine tight?
Yeah, I mean, the evolution of a wine is one of the things a lot of people do love to watch something, but, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole all Americans, but we're not the best at saving wine. So generally, your impression is what you get, and that's a smart move if you can do it. I want to open up this bottle you have here. You have a 2007 Mitra Pinot Noir. Did I say that right? Mitra?
Yes.
Yeah. I have actually had this wine, believe it or
perfect.
Not. But because your father graciously sent me a bottle of this, and it's tremendous. I'm excited to drink it again.
So that is my first vintage when I came into our family business. So, and it's actually the last vintage that I made Mitra, because we changed the whole portfolio for Mesa over time. So this is 100% new oak.
Interesting.
And I did it in 12 months because I had to flip it.
Man, it's good. Ooh, it's
and,
really good.
And it's 37.5%, 113, and 37.5%, 114, and then 25% of Pommard.
You guys writing this down? Okay. it's really, really, I mean, this is the kind of wine that if anybody tastes this, I don't know if this is a compliment or not, but it's incredibly easy to go to Burgundy on a blind tasting with a wine like this. It doesn't seem, it just doesn't seem like I don't know. It doesn't have like the big cherry Coke stuff that you get a lot of times. It just doesn't have the I hate the term New World. It's not a correct term, but it doesn't have those elements that you often get.
You can use that word. It's okay.
Okay.
We'll forgive you.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I mean, what go back to your part was that when I came back to our in 2007, my dad was having some situations, and there was a winemaker that my dad really wanted to take over while I was not going to be here. And he literally told my dad, like, I want this position, but being told in 5 years your daughter is going to come in.
Right.
You know, I want to build something and build my name and build your guys' wines. And
it's understandable.
It was totally understandable. My dad respects him. And still to this day, he says, you know, he is the one that really kind of like told him, is like, you know, bringing another winemaker in and then trying to say, okay, we have a new winemaker. We got to figure out their stylistic. Now we know what my style is and what Mesa means, or what our portfolio is.
Well, I think meanwhile, your father, who I'm going to talk to on another episode of this about his whole story, which is remarkable. One of the best stories in wine, in my opinion. I'm sure he's thinking, my daughter's going to make the wine. She's going to be a proxy for me, based on the fact that she's my daughter and I'm going to be close. And I'm sure you were like, just knowing your personality and knowing all of your sisters and everybody, I'm sure you put a big stamp on this wine. You know, I heard some stories last night at dinner, you and your father butting heads quite a bit.
Oh, we butt heads. We have to butt heads.
Yeah.
If we don't have a butting head each year, then something's wrong. Like,
okay.
So, I mean, we, that, I mean, what I took.
This is this position, a Persian thing? Because this is kind of a cliche for Persians to be like, ready to like
fight. I think it's a father and daughter
fight
thing.
Fight and hug. Yeah, that is a father daughter thing
it's
too.
It's really
yeah.
a father daughter thing. And it's always,
fight
I say,
and hug like within the within 10 minutes. Yeah, that's, yeah. Yeah, that's
because
good.
Because I have that father and daughter relationship, and he's the farmer and I'm the producer. So we understand what we are talking to each other about. Mm-hmm. So when he says this needs to come off, I'm not going to argue with him. It's like, okay, you know, I'm going to figure out how to bring it in.
Right.
But when I took the position, it took 2 weeks for me to think about when he offered me this position.
Yeah, how does your father offer you a job? Like, when he comes with, here's your salary. I mean, how does that negotiation go? Are you just like, I'll walk?
Oh, I must have been really stupid. I was young. I was 24.
Right.
I never talked about salary. I mean, I still am stupid in that sense of asking about getting money from them. But
right.
in the sense of like, it was more what I negotiated was that, you know, I'm going to put a new wine out. I'm going to have my own like label, meaning I'm going to add a new portfolio in there. We're going to change a little bit of things. And, you know, you got to trust me on this. And he turned around and says, let me think about it and let me talk to you. So for 2 weeks, he didn't talk to me for like 2 weeks. And then he comes back and he's like, okay, I want all the wines to be biodynamic. And I literally got so
all
mad
right.
at him.
Biodynamic is the next thing we're going to talk about. Let's do that now. I think this is all the right time for this. So I think when it comes to the topic of biodynamics, and why I really want to get into this with you is because your father is, we just say, this is one of the premier wineries for biodynamics, probably in the United States, if not definitely in Oregon. So I think biodynamics often has some reservations about it. You know, what does it mean? And I think from your perspective as a winemaker who was told, we're going to be biodynamic. I want to know what your opinion was of that.
There's two parts of that. Because I, as a winemaker, and also I always half the time I think as a consumer too, because when mm-hmm. I make my wines, I think of as a consumer, would I drink this?
Mm-hmm.
So as a winemaker, what I understood being told I'm going to do biodynamics was making like, I'd hate using the word raw or natural, but just do it the classic way that you're not manipulating the wines.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was understood that we're doing. But in biodynamics, which I argue with them all the time about, is that there's made with biodynamic grapes and then biodynamic wines. And we have the same certification stamp. So when you go...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it blows my mind sometimes. Like, I go out, you know, to grocery stores and I was like, oh, I would like to buy a biodynamic wine. They're giving me a wine that's made with biodynamic grapes, at which I'm like straight out saying, like, look, it's saying it's made with biodynamic grapes. I don't want that. I want a biodynamic wine that's really made biodynamically, that's natural, that's raw. It's just, I just want what the fruit's going to do. Like, and they get really confused and they're like, well, this is what it says on the label.
Right.
So as for me,
well,
as
for
a
consumers, it's a mess. I mean,
yeah.
Again, that's like 10 podcasts to even try to code.
No, I know.
That maybe no one would want to even listen to anyway.
Yeah.
But
but for me, what a biodynamic wine means, that the fruit has to be certified biodynamic and the winery has to be certified biodynamic. So we're getting inspected in the vineyard and the winery. So we're not chapelizing the wine. We're not acidifying the wine. We're not, I like to say, Jesus is not coming in. You know, we're really getting the fruit and just making it what the vintage gave
Jesus me. Was a big tartaric acid guy. I do remember that.
Yeah.
In Mark 3:12. Yeah.
No, I just definitely what I was understood was we're just going to make the wine. And then the way I also told my dad, if we're going to do this, we're going to tell the story of each vintage. We're not going to mask anything. We're not going to, you know, put a little bit of lipstick and saying it's all good. We're going to say what this vintage is because that's what.
So if it's a tough vintage, that's going to be the wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I had some tough
vintages. Very un-Napa of you to do that.
I mean, it's winemaking of me because some people think I should intervene in 2010, 11 when Oregon didn't get warmed up during the summer. We're around like in 2010, like 60 to 65. And then in 2011, we didn't even get up to like 63 degrees. And it was just, you know, overcast, crappy. You know, I was just like, wait, when is this going to get
better?
So
you made cranberry wine.
Well, Mo will call it rosé, but I will say I made Pinot.
That's really funny. I mean, when the whole process and all the extra steps, this is going to be a stupid question, but hopefully for a smart answer. Are all of these steps, I mean, right now you guys are drying probably a ton of stinging nettle down there on the floor, you know, all of the horsetails, all this stuff. How much of that actually plays into the winemaking, what you taste, and how much of it actually plays into the process and the feeling and all of that? What is the actual outcome for the drinker?
So, I mean, there's some techniques that what biodynamics does, like the like, you know, I wouldn't say stinging nettle, but horse, rose hips and valerian. A very, like, a cooler summer, we can spray valerian and rose hips, and that kind of gives more heat back to the fruit, so we can, like, get a little bit more riper sugars.
How does that work? I mean,
it's science. Okay. I can't explain it.
Like, I'm but really good at science and math, but I don't know how to tell.
Yeah, I can't explain it, but those two components gives heat back to the plant. Mm-hmm. So it just gives them a little bit more a speeding process when your weather is like 75 during the summer. So you're like, okay, I need to do this. We're not getting any, you know, 85, 90 degrees weather or heat days in here. So it's very, those do play a factor of biodynamics into our winemaking, because we don't want to pick 20 bricks and come in here.
Right, right.
And I mean, if we are, then we should be making rosé and, or champagne, or not champagne, sparkling wine.
Sure.
For sure. But I'm making Pinot, so I have to get a little bit riper.
Yeah. So let's talk about Pinot here. Right now, I mean, it seems to me that Pinot is, it's beyond the king and queen of this valley. It's like everything. And you, if I say this completely unabated, like this is something I would just say on my own with my wife. If somebody were to ask me, I want to try 5 of the great Pinots from the United States, I would put Mesara in that list. It would be absolutely like the 5 I'd line up for somebody
to
go.
Well, I'll say thank you.
Well, it's true. Here's how good it can be, and here's how unique it can be, because this is, I don't know if this is mean or not, but a lot of Pinots in every region that grows them, whether it's Santa Barbara, Sonoma, here, there's a lot that are the same. It's just a fact. It just happens that a lot of them end up being, and then that becomes like, this is what Oregon Pinot is like, and it's very good, but there's not a lot of distinction. You guys have a very distinct wine that is also very good, and it's very rare to have that happen, especially in 20-some, 30 years where you've been making wine, for that to be at that level yet. It's really good. That being said, do you feel trapped at all by the fact that Pinot is everything here? That, you know, do you have to do Pinot? Do you wish you were doing other things up here? You know, I'm just curious.
I mean, our region is actually really good for making Pinot.
It really is. No, it's
the right grape to grow here for sure. But if I did have an opportunity of someone like wanting me to offer me some fruit, I would take some Syrah, because I actually do like to drink that myself.
The kind of like Northern Rhone, less heat type of thing.
I would love to do that. And I think I would do something really amazing about it. We do grow Chardonnay a little bit, but it's not like a lot. I've been like trying to get my dad to like get on the bandwagon on Chardonnay, because I know I can make a killer Chardonnay. I know we could do it. Mm-hmm. That's another varietal that I've been begging. But he's also got some Gamay after me complaining for like, you know, 15 years. I'm like, Dad, we should do Gamay. And he's like, no. But he's finally planting some of that too.
What's his argument against Gamay? That it's harder to sell, or that it's just...
He had no interest in it.
Off brand? Really?
We had no interest in it. That's the honest truth. He had no interest and didn't want to do it. And then I think he tasted some of John's wines, and he was like, damn it, this is really good.
John, our producer, is producing this podcast.
Yes. Yeah. He literally tasted it. He's like, damn it. I was like, I've been telling you this for like 16 years. I don't know why you're just catching up. We're also, my dad's like, it takes us a long time to get there, but he's finally getting on the bandwagon on Gamay.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do some like interesting things here that I like try to like spice up my life while during harvest. Just like, oh, we're not doing a typical vintage or, you know, knowing a recipe. What we try to change it up a little bit.
Well, it's funny too, because your father's like, you know, he has had me taste some wines that are wacky in a good way. I mean, he's fermented wine with yarrow. He's done things that are really off the path of a lot of the things you guys have done. So I'm surprised that he's not like, all right, you want to do Trousseau? Let's try it. I mean, I'm surprised he's not doing that with Gamay or whatever else. But
he
also
likes to do a little bit.
I am a father, so I also understand kind of, it's like a, do as I say, and then occasionally it just becomes you think it's your idea when it really wasn't. I've watched myself become this old man, you know, kind of thing. So what other varietals? So right now you guys are doing Pinot Blanc.
Yeah.
You do Pinot Gris.
I do Riesling.
That's right. You do a Riesling.
I do a Riesling.
And then you do, obviously, lots of Pinot Noir. What else besides Syrah and Gamay would you like to see up here?
For Chard, for sure.
Chardonnay, yeah. And a lot of people are doing great Chardonnay, you know?
I don't know. I thought Tempranillo was the next big red fruit in Oregon.
Interesting. It's a long ripening, though.
Yeah, well, I thought of global warming. I was like, it's going to happen. Because in 2014, 15, and 16, I was like, this has to happen. It's like,
it was really hot.
It was really hot. I was like, I think people need to grow some Tempranillo here because it's really a great idea. But then, you know, typical Oregon vintage did happen, and you're like, okay, maybe not.
Yeah, you'd had green grapes at the end of the season. Yeah, that'd be tricky.
Yeah, so I mean, in that sense, I think I would play it safe. Maybe it's the mom in me now. Like, I was like, okay, let's just go baby steps now.
Yeah.
Maybe if you talked to me about, like, you know, 10 years ago, like, I was like, let's do it. Just try it.
It'd be interesting. I think Tempranillo could be an interesting challenge. You would have to do some adjustments, though. Vintage by vintage, that would be.
But it has to be Southern Oregon.
Oh, right. Okay. So Southern Oregon. Like Rogue Valley type of place. Yeah. Like, yeah, you could definitely do it down there. It gets hot.
Yeah. So I thought of that, but right now, like, I think for the varieties here in this valley and the Willamette, I think those are the safest ones. But the Syrah, I would definitely get it from like Walla Walla area.
Okay. Interesting. So you'd get the fruit.
Yeah. I don't think you can grow it here. It needs more heat. Or if you plant a lot of rocks around it.
I know we're off on a tangent, but I will say, you know, there are some really great, I mean, PAX over in Sonoma does some really great low alcohol, early pick. Syrah, that's really nice. I mean, the Northern Rhone, there are some vintages where it is really thin, and it's still really good.
No, I agree, but I think I would pick early.
Yeah.
See, that's where I think there needs to be picked, done in a right location. The acidity and the alcohol and tannins have to like balance each other. Mm-hmm. I know there's three, so you can't say a seesaw or to do it. But those three components, if you pick the right time.
You could also co-ferment. You could do a little bit of white with it and lift it up a little bit. I mean.
True. I could do that. But I'm a sucker to be 100%.
I was going to say, man, if there's anyone in the room I don't want to fight, it's you.
Yeah. I'm 100% on that because I'm scared. I do make a white wine. I call it White Owl, and it's our Muscat that's grown on this estate.
I've actually had it. It's great.
So I play with that a lot. But it's
a very unexpected wine, though. I don't know what I would call it ever if I was given it without knowing what it was, but it's really tasty. It's really good.
Thank you. I mean, it's a fun wine that I make during harvest. It's just like to give me some like, oh, look, some other varieties. Like we had the little bit of the Muscat, a little bit of the Riesling, the Pinot Gris, and the Pinot Blanc, and then just use those four grapes and saying, here is something fun for you guys to drink.
Amazing.
And people think, like, when they smell it, they're like, oh, my God, it's going to be really sweet. But they're like, oh, whoa, it's not that sweet. I like to do that to people.
Yeah. Let's talk really fast just to wrap this up. What's the culture of the Willamette, of this wine region? How is it different from other regions? And then how are the AVAs within here different from each other?
Well, definitely the AVAs are very different from each other because here being in the McMillan AVA, we're in the mouth of the Van Duzer Corridor. And then being like an hour away from the coast. So we get a little bit of the coastal breeze. And
the Van Duzer Corridor sounds like some very complex, like Norwegian math problem or something.
It took me a long time. I was like wondering who is Van Duzer? And it was a park ranger apparently that he was kind of studying it. And then he was seeing there was like a wind gust and they named it after him. Mm-hmm. That's what I was told. But, I mean, it's a park ranger. I would definitely read that. But he hits this little one. I don't know how. It's like kind of like a spiral, it looks like a blow of mouth just hits through like a little bit of the Alloa Amity. But the McMinnville AVA gets a little bit, we're in like the middle of the eye of the mouth of the
Van Duzer corridor.
Yeah. So, I mean, that aspect of it, so our grapes here. So I think that one of your things about how this area is so different is that our tannins are so strong, so we don't punch down any of our wines at all. We do a pulse air and pump over. So we're very like respectful that the tannins are going to be big and monster, so we just back away a little bit.
And partly why you hold your wine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I sit there and I'm like telling people, I'm like, don't punch it, like really. And then like my dad's like, punch it. I'm like, no, don't, please. And also Pinot Noir is a fragile grape to work with. So you have to respect what the fruit is. So, I mean, it can't take the abuse. So that's one thing. Another thing that I think we always think about is that we're working with a finicky fruit. We need to be very soft and gentle with it. So mm-hmm. not to abuse it.
It's rare that people talk about tannins when they're talking about,
Pinot. I mean, I live in Newburgh and I'm in the Ribbon. They told me, yeah, I live in the Ribbon Ridge area near that area. So I like, it's totally different. Like, the wind is not as much.
Are you happy with where the winery is and where your fruit is? When you look at some of these other regions that don't have the tannin issues, are you like, man, it'd be nice if we were over there? Or?
No, I actually, for the farm aspect of it, I do appreciate where my location is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I will say, I wish the first facility that my dad, or the property my dad was looking at, we were there, because tourism was way better.
Right,
that
right.
We're really out in the beaten path. So you really got to drive through here to see us.
But it's one of the more beautiful regions, though. I mean, driving through the Willamette is not ugly. So
no, it's not ugly, but you have
to
start with us. I always tell people, start with us.
Uh-huh.
And then if you're going to Portland,
work out
yep. there, or work up or work down. But start with us first.
Yeah, that's great. So where do you see kind of your winemaking style and what you're going to try to do in the next, say, 10 years, 15 years? Is it going to be stick to what you have done and just keep it at this level of quality? Or do you have any big aspirations to change things?
I do have aspirations to change, tweak little things every year, because I don't think, that I'm like figured all the answers up, because I think I'll be dead, because
yeah, then
then I figured everything.
What else do you have to live for? Yeah.
Oh yeah. So that, to answer your question, I think tweaking things or understanding certain things. I'll be honest about this, because everyone knows this. I will say I'm not a good whole cluster winemaker. I don't think I'm a great whole cluster winemaker. I mean, my dad pushes me on that, and so that's maybe an aspiration to become a better whole cluster Pinot winemaker.
Are we allowed to talk about this whole cluster story from when you first started?
Oh, yeah, you could talk about it. My dad will tell you a different story.
So here's what I was told last night at dinner. I was told that he did carbonic whole cluster, and you dumped you dumped the entire vintage. So you were...
It was like 3 barrels.
Oh, okay. It was only that much. From what I understand, The wine is in tank or barrel, and you hated it. It wasn't working, and you dumped it all. And your father was very pissed off. This is this is my understanding.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
this really what?
So the story, yes.
I mean, that's
so
some gall for you to just go, we're not going to see this to the end. I'm just going to dump it.
No, it was really bad.
Set it up. Set this up for me better.
So we did a whole cluster, 100% whole cluster wine, and this was like 2008. Vintage.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're brand new. This is like your second year, right?
Though it was my first, very first vintage.
Very first vintage. Okay.
Because 2009 was my second, and then I really did it. I just wasn't happy with it. And I was tasting it, and then I was like, something's really wrong with this wine. Because when I was tasting it, the color was losing. So I've never seen wine like it was granite color. And it turned to like pale. Like it would turn like this like really, really light color. And I was like, what the hell happened? And then I was tasting it, and I was like, this does not taste good.
Mm-hmm.
I gave the sample to my dad. I will say that. I did give it to him. And I said, hey, taste this. And he is like, oh, this is not good. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's not good. I think I'm going to dump it. Yeah, definitely dump it. Never told him it was his whole cluster. So I dumped it. And then he turns around later and is like, hey, what happened to that whole cluster? And I'm like, oh, remember that wine you tasted? And he's like, yeah, that was your whole cluster. And he's like, you dumped it? And I was like, yeah. And I did get cussed out. But if I wasn't his daughter, if it was another, like—
Probably gotten fired.
Yeah, well, not fired. They would be pissed at my dad cussing them out. But I literally did— I mean, to this day, I stand behind my words. That wine was horrible. I am scared of it. I still have nightmares of that wine being in my cellar. Maybe, you know, there's a ghost hunting me down, like the saying, like, hey, I'm going to fuck with you here.
Yeah,
like,
your dad didn't talk to you for a while after this, right?
He didn't talk to me. And then the next harvest came, he's like, I'm watching you. And I was like, okay, I did make it. I did a whole cluster, but we made a deal. I will do 100% whole cluster and we'll do a 50% whole cluster. Mm-hmm. And see, you know, vice versa, how they look like each, like by side by side. And he was like, fine, but amazing. I'm not going, you know, you're not dumping this, but I didn't dump it. So 09 was our very, very first vintage that I did 100%, did it, I committed, we bottled it, we have some, but yes. But I got a little bit smarter on the labeling on aspect of it because they both were called Al, and one was called Al 100 and Al 50, and everyone got confused. So now it's like the 50% is the Al, and then the 100% is called Matab. So no one's confused.
Oh my God, this is just amazing. I think you are your father's daughter.
Oh, I definitely am. I have his personality. I'm quiet in the sense, and I do my things, and then later like announce it. I'm like, oh, I did this, by the way. That's half of the things I do in here.
Yeah, well, you make stupendous wines, and thankfully your father has the patience to see his younger self to go through the process. Tomina, it's an honest pleasure to taste
Cheers.
This wine with you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Tomina Mumtazi and the entire family there at Maysara Winery for the hospitality. This is a really, really good wine. I strongly recommend that you pick up some of their Pinot Noir. It is fantastic stuff. And look for them in our upcoming film, Cup of Salvation. You won't believe why they're in this movie. Go to SomTV.com. Make sure you go. We have great stuff coming. We have the documentary on Burgundy. We also have a documentary on William Selyem. And there's new content every single week. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of the absolute best food and wine content you can find. James Beard award-winning food and wine content that you can find anywhere else. SomTV.com. I also want to thank John Adams, our podcast producer, and I want to thank all of you for listening to the very end. If you love this podcast, please, please, please give us a great review wherever you listen. Apple Pods, Spotify, anywhere. It really helps us out. All right, everybody, be safe and enjoy a good glass for me.